Smokey. Show him.
That's silly.
Shoot him now! Shoot him now!
I gotcha!
Hello everyone, welcome to That's Not Quite All Folks, a Lean To His Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Callum, joined by...
I'm Jordan Schmidt, and today we're going to be talking about three different satires of Hollywood politics in the 1940s, and two of them aren't actually satirical in any way, because, you know, you should probably know what satire is if you're going into the cartoon satire business. Anyway, I'm not bitter or anything, Mark. No, it's not like any of these cartoons made me really bitter. I'm in a great mood. I'm in a wonderful mood. It's phenomenal. What are we doing this week, Mark? What are we doing?
Pretty much what you said. We are going to be talking about Hollywood in the 1940s. Don't click off. Please, do not click off, okay? We will educate you. Well, actually, you probably should know your history of 1940s Hollywood icons if you're into Leantunes podcast.
Yes. But,
so today we're going to be talking about three classic-ish cartoons. What's Cookin' Doc, Hollywood Steps Out, and Slick Hair.
Yes, and this is a very... Like, you know, thematically they're obviously connected, but there's actually some very subtle connections in between some of these that we're going to get into that we didn't even realize when we booked this one.
Oh, no.
But this is basically because, you know, we've discussed this in the Tweety episode, I believe, but a lot of the early Looney Tunes era ones got a lot of their jokes and a lot of their laughs by making very surface level sort of references to Hollywood and to a lot of the movie personnel of that era. Because, you know, again, they were mostly doing it for themselves. They're like, what if we put Humphrey Bogart here? What if we make Charles Boyer a skunk? Or it's them making very surface level things, and basically because they don't have the energy to do actual jokes and gags.
Also, it's pretty much them, because a constant theme you'll find in these three shorts is kind of a mockery of the rich and famous
yes.
people of that time. The joke being that the people who wrote and directed these shorts are not invited to the events and galas that are depicted in these shorts.
Exactly.
They made fun of the 1% before it was cool.
Exactly. Because again, it's very exactly. much a, you know, the termite terrorist mentality of this early era is we are a bunch of starving artists trying to make our big break. And if it takes making fun of the rich for a little bit, then sure, let's do that. Because they're an easy target. I mean, it's not like they're going to fight back in any way. They have enough money to be satisfied. But yeah, a lot of this, a lot of the three that we're looking on is them sort of poking fun at not only the rich, but rich celebrities, which, you know, is very much, this is the 30s and 40s celebrity culture with movies is the first real niche boom, but the first time it's not really like a sort of a niche kind of thing where it's like they're actually superstars. You think of, you know, Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney, Katharine Hepburn, Greta Garbo as these larger than life and larger than their own film sort of figures. You don't really get that now with movie stars are the products of their movies. They're not like colossal outside of them, with very few exceptions. Now it's going to be very interesting looking at these, especially considering that, you know, the cartoons are made at a very lower class standpoint, even though one of the directors we're going to be talking about is very much a greedy, you know, I want that fame and fortune kind of guy.
Daffy Duck?
If it was Daffy Duck, I'd say a lot more nice things. Since it's the first cartoon we're covering, I might as well say that it's Bob Clampett. Now, I'm going to preface this again. I know that I've been a little... I don't know if mean is the right word, but I haven't liked a lot of the Bob Clampett cartoons we've covered here. We both had a lot of very critical things to say about what was the name of it? Not A Tale of Two.
A Tale of Two Kitties.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Kitties.
Good, good, good. Because I was going to confuse it with Life with Feathers, but that one was actually good. But no, A Tale of Two Kitties we didn't like because Bob Clampett didn't really get a lot of the speed of animation stuff. And I've had a lot of nitpicks on his personality, on his sort of I'm bigger than all of you kind of shtick. And I want to be fair, and I want to actually give credit where credit is due, that he's actually a very smart, ahead of his time sort of filmmaker. But he's not making it easy, folks. If there are any Bob Clampett fans listening, I'm trying to be fair. We both are. But the one I had to cover, the first one we're covering is What's Cooking, Doc, which is a Bob Clampett short. Michael Sasanoff wrote it, not very well-known Warner personalities and writers. Maybe he was just a Clampett guy. I don't know, have a lot of knowledge about him. This cartoon is basically Bob Clampett's response to the Academy Awards not giving Warner Brothers any Oscars by this point. It's basically because this one is on the heels of two specific Academy Awards in the early 1940s. It is off the heels of the 1942 ceremony where the Warner Brothers have, you know, the animation division of Warner Brothers has their short, which up for an award, which is Hiawatha's Rabbit Hunt, which is a very early Bugs Bunny appearance that hasn't aged very well at all. And it loses Best Animated Short to a Disney short, a Pluto cartoon called Lend a Paw, which has probably aged a little better because it doesn't have any Native American stereotypes. So Clampett is mad and bitter at this. And this is also on the heels of the 1943 ceremony, where James Cagney wins Best Actor for Yankee Doodle Dandy. And James Cagney, I will not say any bad things about. James Cagney's an amazing actor. His stuff in Angels with Dirty Faces, The Public Enemy, White Heat, Man of a Thousand Faces, 1, 2, 3, even Ragtime. He's a fantastic actor, one of the first big tough guys in cinema history. If you don't enjoy him, we need to have a conversation. He wins for a musical. He wins for Yankee Doodle Dandy, playing George M. Cohan, this big vaudeville pioneer. And it's a very soft role for him. And it's seen by a lot of people at this point as the Academy giving him an Oscar just because they missed so many other times for his gangster films.
And that's something the Academy has done even today. The usually it's called like, it's the lifetime, not lifetime achievement Oscar. You know, they'll usually give it to an actor who like, okay, listen, this really isn't your best role, but we didn't, like, Whoopi Goldberg. It's the Whoopi Goldberg effect of, hey, we did nominate you in Color Purple. You're in Ghost. Look, here's the Oscar for Ghost, but it's really for the Color Purple. It's that sign, kind of Oscar mentality.
I actually think she deserved it for Ghost. I actually, the better example is, without naming names, because I'm going to go on a rant, say there is this actor who did a lot of really good method performances over the last 10 years. Say he got nominated for a lot of Oscars for some very good issue movies, some very good avant-garde movies, and didn't win any. And say this very well-liked and well-known method actor does a movie recently that isn't very good, that is basically lifted on the performance of him as an all-out wackadoo, and is basically given the Oscar for doing this method stuff in a very palatable way, in a very Oscar-palatable movie, even if it's dog crap. I'm not going to say who. I'm not going to, oh, Joaquin Phoenix, say who it is. But it's just, it still happens to this day. And it's happened a lot. You can also say that this with Leonardo DiCaprio with winning for The Revenant when he should have won for Wolf of Wall Street. Yes. You can say this with Kate Winslet winning for The Reader, which she should have won for Titanic. You can say this about so many different people. But honestly, Jimmy Cagney might have been the first. And so Jimmy Cagney winning in 1943 for Yankee Doodle Dandy must have really riled up some people at Warner Brothers, especially Clampett, because they make this cartoon. And the funny thing is that it's very much a big passion project on the heels of the 1943 Oscars, and they spend the second half of 1943 making it. And it's not released until January 8th, 1944. Not much to report on because, like some of the other cartoons in this period, there's war going on.
The war.
Yeah, World War II is going on this day. There's some the big war thing that I read on it, January 1944, is that some Philippine troops are doing battle in Japan. Not a great part for the whole world, really. But on a lighter note, Hitchcock's Lifeboat was in theaters. So, go nice. Alfred. But yeah, this is basically, this cartoon is a direct response from Bob Clampett to the Warner Brothers division's repeated snubbings in the Best Animated Short category. And if you get a sense of bitterness, that's basically what this is.
Just gonna say. No, now knowing about this background info, thinking about the short we're about to talk about, my God, he is so bitter.
And so... I want to point this out before I get into the actual cartoon proper. Clampett's overall thesis at this point, which we mentioned with the whole Phoenix parable, is people who win the Oscars are not the most deserving, but the ones who do the most campaigning. And Bob has a point here. The reason Miramax wins a bunch of Oscars in a row in the 90s and early 2000s is because of noted dirtbag Harvey Weinstein's rigorous campaign and smear tactics, leading to a lot of his movies winning top honors undeservingly in some points. To this day, the Oscars will award movies like Green Book, Crash, and Joker for appealing to old Oscar voter sensibilities rather than being, ahem, the best movie of the year. As much as I bag on Clampett, and I will continue to in this podcast, he's sort of right. But I'm actually going to get into this cartoon, and he's right on that, but not in the realm of this cartoon. So we'll get into what's cooking, Doc. This cartoon, cleverly enough, begins with live-action still photography and moving images, as we see Hollywood. And it's very, you know, narrator's involved, you know, it's 1940s Hollywood, look at all the sights. And this is a very cool way of leading us into the sort of Hollywood we'll be lampooning here. But it's very much, you know, the glitz, the glamour. He's showing all these great landmarks in Hollywood. And all of a sudden, he's interrupted by a howling dog voiced by Mel. And he's like, oh, how'd that get in there? That's a great game.
Taking them down a peg, you know, just, you kind of like imagine Clampett going like, oh, Hollywood, what a grand place. Oh, in the Hollywood Bowl, and all these tourist trap destinations that don't mean shit.
It's the first speech that Danny DeVito has in L.A. Confidential. Come to Hollywood. Do some things. See the sights. If you're rich. That's my attempt at a Danny DeVito impression. I don't know whether or not it was good. So if you listen to this whenever it comes out, and if my Danny DeVito is shit, let me know. I'll do better impressions later in this. We get to the basis of this. The one figure that draws the entire city's attention, little Oscar. And by the way, real quick, we have a newspaper slide here about the Oscars happening. And we see some of the other headlines on this. And remember, this is 1944, but mostly 1943. And some of the stuff, our Japanese cruiser is blown up. And I substituted a slur for Japanese because I'm not going to do a slur.
Yeah, that's, oh no.
And another one, Adolf Hitler commits suicide is one of the headlines on here. And by the way, Adolf is spelled with a PH. Again, the wishful thinking of the writers is just really shining through here. We do get the actual live action footage of the actual Oscar ceremony from 1942, which is very cool. I do find it ironic that this usage would make the cartoon ineligible for animation Oscar, I believe.
Oh, really?
I think so, because I think animation Oscars can't have any live action footage or else it's sort of skewed into both categories. I'm not exactly sure. Don't quote me on it. But I feel like that might make it hard to actually be taken serious as an animated short. You'll be the judge at home. We cut to, okay. The narrator's going, who is going to take home the Oscar? And we cut to Bugs, and Bugs is at his own table, animated, chopping on a carrot, going, it's in the bag. And this is an early Mel Blanc characterization, but all of these impressions he does as Bugs, and he does a Catherine Hepburn impression right here as Bugs, they're pretty great. Like, after this, he does a hello to both Cecil B. and Edward G., which is a 1940s version of Uma, Oprah, Oprah, Uma, with that Dave Letterman would do at the 95 Oscars. And then he does a very quick Edward G. Robinson impression, very good. He also does a very wild Jerry Colonna impression, one of the ones here I had to look up. And he's in a couple that we're covering today. And then he goes into a really accurate Bing Crosby. So this is a Mel showcase, this cartoon, and he's doing a really good job. It's actually very funny he does Bing Crosby. This is the part of Bing Crosby's career where he's Bracted Oscars almost every year because he's doing Going My Way in 1944, Bells of St. Mary's 1945. He's really making his way as an actor in this period, not just as, you know, local crooner, Bing Crosby. So it's very interesting that he includes him in there. So, okay, we get to the award. Mel Blanc dubbing over live footage of whoever was hosting, also very clever. Bugs is doing the whole I'm going to get the award shtick. A lot of Bob Clampett or just Warner Brothers in general cartoons had Bugs in the part of the greedy, overconfident, I'm going to win type. And that's also the thesis of his Tortoise and Hare short that were also popular in these era. Tortoise wins by hair, Tortoise beats hare, all of those. And I feel like this isn't exactly the version of Bugs that'd be best known.
There's a reason why Daffy's really good as being greedy.
Yeah.
That it's funner. Like for some reason, the act of being greedy just works better in a duck than it does in a rabbit. So yes. When you think Bugs Bunny, you think he's a smart ass. He outwits people, not power hungry, envious for recognition, wants the acclaim of love of everyone around him. Bugs already has that, and he knows that. No, actual Bugs. A good written Bugs character already knows this. He doesn't have to try to win an award or anything. He knows, okay, if I get it, cool, thanks. But if Daffy has shown in plenty of shorts, he demands that he wins the Oscar. Bugs would never demand the Oscar, which makes this character just odd.
It's very. It's not my favorite way of using Bugs. And yeah, as the presenter describes the winner, Bugs waits by the stage thinking it's him. We've seen this before. It's been done in every cartoon before and since, yada, yada. The guy says he's good at romantic roles. Bugs does a Charles Boyer impression. He mentions character roles. Bugs does a Frankenstein's monster impression, which made me smile.
Really good animation on that.
It's great. And of course, it's presented to James Cagney for Yankee Doodle Dandy. So they thought of this in April 1942, spent the whole year working on it. I already said that. So Bugs overreacts, which is a good way to describe the rest of this damn cartoon. He overreacts, and he leaves the opinion to the audience. And, you know, he basically goes, of course, you know, what would you guys say? Do you guys think I'm the best actor? And he throws a couple reels of some of my best scenes at the projectionist. The okay smoky roll'em is a line that WB would use contemporarily in a few points, as would we.
Well, we're not perfect.
Oh, well. I love the gag, the reel that Bugs hands the projectionist is the wrong one. It's a stag reel presented by an actual stag. That and Bugs' hey reaction cracked me.
Okay, what is a stag? Like my first impression was like,
you don't know what a stag reel is?
I don't actually. Well, what is that?
You know the term stag party, right?
Actually don't.
Stag party is an old term for bachelor party.
Oh!
And at old stag parties, they would show basically porno reels, essentially.
I was watching, I'm like, is this like porn? I'm like, oh, it is. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Okay. So here we get a clip of the cartoon that was supposed to be up for the Oscar and should have won in the eyes of Bob Clampett, which is Hiawatha's Rabbit Hunt, the short that lost the Oscars.
And this is the most bitter thing I can think of for a cartoon. Yes. Just, you didn't give Ed Hunt. Now, is Wacky Teeny Rabbit, is that a Clampett short? Like, was that Clampett's short that didn't win, or was it just a Bugs Bunny short?
Hiawatha's Rabbit Hunt, you mean?
Yeah.
That's a Fritz Freeling short.
It's a Freeling short. Okay, anyways.
That's the part that sort of confuses me because he has, maybe it's just sort of having the pride of this division needs to win one, even if it's not actually his film.
Yeah, but just, and then just for what, like a minute, like for a good long while, all of a sudden the entire audience, the Academy audience and the audience in the theater as they're showing the short, all of a sudden, we play this other cartoon. And that's really annoying.
And I don't want to get this wrong, but is Hiawatha's Rabbit Hunt one of the ones that was in the Censored 11, or am I confusing it with another one?
It's okay. It's now part of Censored 11.
Okay. Well, it should be, because, you know, it's really offensive Native American stereotypes. And even if he's doing a yup character, it's still making fun of Native Americans, yeah. Which you really shouldn't do. Okay. But yeah, it's a minute or so long clip of this that ends abruptly. It's basically Bob Clampett saying, "See, you should have given this an Oscar." In 1943, maybe they could have gone, "Okay, yeah, I see your point." But in 2020, no,
that's not even close to Bugs's early best work.
Yeah, and also the clip they show is fairly standard. It's a fairly standard gag. But then after this, at least they get you back, because Bugs Bunny goes bounding in after the clip ends with just a big bass drum with "Let Bugs Have It" on it, which is very funny.
That's good.
And, you know, eventually, you know, Bugs, you know, complains, and then eventually the guy is like, "Well, what do you think? Should we let him have it?" And they throw vegetables at him. And Verjord about Bugs wanting to get an Oscar. The ending where he gets one is very rushed, and Bugs just cradles this booby prize Oscar that he gets until it kisses him back, does a Burt Gordon, "Do you mean it?" And it ends with a boo. And for the record, anybody wondering out there, it's Burt Gordon, the radio personality, not Burt I. Gordon, the director of all the movies that were on Mystery Science Theater. It should be a bit more climactic of him actually getting the Oscar, other than just a, you know, gag, hook out.
It seems like for a cartoon that was made purely out of spite, I think would have been a little more meaner. Like, maybe Bugs, like, is like a crazy, I don't know, like Bugs, like, torches down the Academy Award or he just tells them all to go whatever the 1940s version of "fuck yourself" is, you know, just so like big movement, and instead it's just this silly little gag. It's like, I don't know, Bob, were you really that mad? Because most you did was force everyone to rewatch a minute of a not very good Bugs Bunny cartoon. That seems to be the worst of it.
Yeah, it's the essence of Bob Clampett to make everybody watch a cartoon that isn't very good and then say, "Now react."
Hey, that's our job. No.
Too close to home there. This one, what else is there to say? It's a bitter, wild cartoon with a skewed thesis statement, a few good jokes, and no one for Bugs to work off of. I mean, on one hand, it's nice to see a Mel Blanc solo showcase. But on the other hand, the Hollywood satire that he's trying to do is kind of skewed. Clampett's point, as I've discussed, is the people who get Oscars don't deserve it. And let's look at what he's saying. He's saying Jimmy Cagney doesn't deserve it for Yankee Doodle Dandy. And while that's not his best role, it's not his worst either. He's fine in that role. He deserves it a bit more than, say, Warner Brothers deserves an Oscar for Hiawatha's Rabbit Hunt, which is racist, basic, and not worthy of an Oscar. So Clampett's real point here is, screw decency and being nice, just give me the Oscar. Not Bugs, Bob. Even if Freeling directed Hiawatha's Rabbit Hunt, Clampett wants it for WB and therefore himself, because in 1944, he is Warner Brothers Animation. His ego usurps everything else about it. And that's honestly the essence of Bob Clampett in this era, and why I can't really get behind a lot of his cartoons, because his ego and his delusions of cartoon grandeur are not for me. So What's Cookin', Doc is a vanity project based on the loss of an undeserving cartoon at the Oscars and satirizing Hollywood for the wrong reason. Even if they're good gags, this is not a favorite of mine. 2.5 anvils out of 5.
Yeah, and also, here's my little theory. So this cartoon was released in 1944. Bugs didn't win the Oscar until 1958. So my theory is shortly after, in the world of this cartoon, shortly after Bugs won the booby prize and went home, the entire Academy went, "Let's blacklist this guy. So they blacklist him for like pretty 14 much. Years until, sure enough, Frizz Freleng. All those years later, Frizz Freleng does actually win an Oscar for Bugs Bunny cartoon. So,
yeah, because he deserves exactly. it. I mean, it is. I mean, how else could you explain that Speedy Gonzalez gets an Oscar and Bugs doesn't?
Oh, we'll get there. That's
we'll get there.
As for my rating, I'm giving it. Give it a 3 out of 5. I don't know. My thing is, I found the short decent. Though, of course, in talking, I'm like, yeah, this is a rather spiteful cartoon, which is weird because, like, that's the thing with Warner Brothers is it can be spiteful. You know, look at like how many times mm-hmm. they made fun of Disney back in the 40s. You know, it's they were able to take their shots. But I felt like it, but besides the fact that, yeah, it's just Bugs saying, give me the Oscar, it doesn't have a real sense of purpose. And heck, have you seen better satire of the Oscars from the Looney Tunes? The entire third mm-hmm. act of the Looney Bugs Bunny movie is an Oscar satire.
And it's great. We have like, 5 episodes until we have to cover that one? It's great.
We're almost there.
Yeah.
It literally was Cooking Doc, but better. Clips of older mm-hmm. cartoons at all.
Better cartoons.
Yes. So yeah, this cartoon. And what kills me is I remember back in the day, Jorn, when this was either one of your favorite cartoons or is one of the ones.
Really?
Yeah, like, maybe it's one of the ones you just really wanted to go and collect. But I don't remember having this.
Yes,
like,
I did.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you really wanted this short on a Golden Collection back in the day. And, man, it would not have been worth it.
No. Because I remember seeing it back then, and I'm like, well, what's the point of this? He just does some impressions and gets mad about not getting an Oscar. What's your so what? What's your plot? What's your reason for being other than just filleting Bob Clampett's ego? Speaking of filleting Bob Clampett's, look for Ruth Clampett's book out now. You knew it was coming, which was the title.
She's an author. All right.
All right. I'm sorry. I got rather heated on that one. That's probably the maddest I've gotten at a Looney Tunes cartoon yet.
That's okay. So our next short of satire is Hollywood Steps Out.
Mm-hmm.
It was released on May 24th, 1941.
Yes.
Now, you're a big music person.
Yes, I am.
Music person.
Yeah.
Do you know why that date is important?
Once again, I'm gonna go with my default. I'm gonna say that the world's biggest dildo machine was made in Norway.
The world's biggest indie rock star was born that day.
Yeah. I should know this, shouldn't I? When you say indie rock, do you mean like
we're talking like folk stuff?
John Prine?
No, go Still Breathing. That's awful. That's awful. No.
John Prine's corpse is choice. Still warm as different we choice. As we record.
Different choice.
I have no idea. I'm probably going to guess wrong again.
Bob? Okay. Bob friggin' Dylan.
Oh, shoot.
Bob.
I should have known that.
Bob goddamn Dylan is born on this day. Singer of such songs as Like a Rolling Stone and
Just Like a Woman, Rainy Day Women, number 18 and 35. I Want You.
Times they are
changing. Why am I blanking?
I know, what the
shit? You gotta serve somebody. To make you feel my love. Lots and lots of other amazing songs. And he was one of the chief members of the Traveling Wilburys, one of the best supergroups of the 1980s with Tom Petty, Jeff Lynne, George Harrison, and Roy Orbison. He is rock, an icon of rock and roll. And I feel bad that I didn't know that his birthday was on that day.
Neither did I. Wow. That's awesome. All right. So
this is for Bob Dylan.
This short, directed by Tex Avery.
Yeah.
It's written by Melvin Millar.
Yeah.
So here's the plot of this cartoon. It's a collection of gags in regards to the Hollywood heavyweights of the early 1940s.
Right.
And pretty much if you pay attention in film appreciation, especially in the beginning when talking about the 40s shorts of that era, you might get a little reward out of this by not having to look up what's about like a quarter of people.
Yeah, something like that.
There's a few to look up. For the most part, you see their faces, you know who they are.
Yeah.
So,
by the way, before you get into this, the one thing I will say about this short is that it's a very rare 1940s Warner Brothers short in that Mel Blanc only voices one character. All the other ones are voiced by Kent Rogers and Sarah Berner. But Mel Blanc only voices Jerry Colonna in this one.
Yeah, it's two lines in the short. I will point out when we get there. So, so to start out with this, you know, bird's eye view of Los Angeles. There are skylights in the sky. They're moving along to a conga beat, and we go to the Ciro's nightclub, which was a real location in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And our first joke is that dinner is $50 and up, and you can put a down payment in order to pay for your dinner, which that's great. And apparently $50 and up would equal to about $869.12 today.
Ooh, doing your research. Nice.
Yeah.
Inflation. It sucks. Anyway.
So the first celebrities that we see, by the way, these are celebrities. The caricatures are done by, or they're based on the caricatures of Ben Shankman, who was someone who worked at the studio at the time, who had a side hustle doing these caricatures of these celebs. So, yeah, so the first people we see are Claudette Colbert, Anne Amici.
Donna Meach.
And at the tail behind them, there's Adolph Menjul and Norma Shearer.
Yeah.
And then Cary Grant is...
Okay, good. One you've heard of. Yeah.
Yes, one I've heard of. Okay. And Cary Grant, who is C.L. Owen. And Cary Grant's, his first lines of dialogue are just references to his movies.
Yes.
No, he drops a reference about My Favorite Wife. He drops a reference about The Awful Truth. He drops a reference of The Front Page, which this is how old it was. At the time, it was called The Front Page, but between 1941 and when it got released, it was renamed to His Girl Friday.
Yeah.
And then the actress Greta Garbo shows up. She's a cigarette girl, you know. I like the old fashioned days at the baseball stadium and someone yells for cigarettes.
Yeah.
She takes off her shoes. She has large feet. That's the joke. I said, she takes, you know, takes smoke. We then transition to, of course, you know, Edward G. Robinson, who was referenced in the previous short. Right. He's asking, you know, Anne Sheridan, you know, how is the oomph girl tonight? And this is because at the time, Anne Sheridan was Warner Brothers' like oomph girl. Like, oh, you know, we need a little moxie in this movie. We need a little oomph. Get me Anne Sheridan. So, and of course, her joke is just says oomph. That's her lines, which it's pretty funny.
All the 90-year-olds listening to this podcast are dying by this point.
Oh, God, I hope not.
I mean, no, dying laughing.
I hope they're not.
I'm sorry. And once again, another apology to the family of John Prine. I'm sorry. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry.
The Anchor Analytics actually does tell me there are like older folks who are listening to this. I don't know where, but they are. So,
and if you're listening to this and you're older than 90, it's good to have you.
All right, so
This is just another one of those podcasts where we're both just in really weird, goofy moods. So we apologize in advance.
All right. So then cut to a tracking shot. The camera pans through some tables. And all of a sudden, the Looney Tunes theme plays because...
Leon and Henry Binder.
And I'm just waving at the audience, which...
That's good.
That's good. And again, that's a... Again, kind of a callback to the fact that while the Warner Brothers directors and writers of these shorts couldn't come to these events, Leon Schlesinger could.
Yeah, Leon Schlesinger was strapped. And then...
And then we have this ag that I didn't really like, but Joe just, you know, because the seat has it's reserved for Betty Davis... And then there's a large sofa because for Kate Smith was a big girl. So,
do you know the significance behind Kate Smith in regards to where we are geographically?
Oh, please do.
Kate Smith was essentially the mascot of the 1976 Philadelphia Flyers because she was basic. Because what the version of God Bless America that plays at Flyers games at Philadelphia sports games for a while was the Kate Smith version because she was this sort of bawdy good luck charm for the sort of the dirty nasty 70s Flyers that won all those championships. And now I don't know a lot about hockey, but I know a lot about those Flyers teams, you know, Bobby Clark, Bob Kelly, Bill Barber. Those were some fun teams. And Kate Smith was the big centerpiece of, you know, the sort of good luck charm of all of that. Because she would come to all those games and sing God Bless America. And this was her renewed interest in Kate Smith. And for a while, there was a statue outside of the Philadelphia sports complex of Kate Smith. And recently it was removed because Kate Smith has had some very problematic views on minorities. So,
I hate to see it.
Yep. I mean, not anymore. She's also...
She's been dead since 1986. How's that possible?
Well, it's the kind of thing where, like, you go back and, you like, there was, like, something she recorded that was, like, a really racist song, I think. And people were like, let's cancel her for that. I know she's dead, but let's do it anyway.
Let's see her. She called racial tolerance in 45, says race, hatred, social prejudice. Oh,
controversy.
Let's see. Those against the patient works and this terrible nature of the show. Oh, Lordy! Oh, no!
Oh. What was it?
All right. Those against the discontinuation of using Kate Smith's works have cited the... Oh my, okay, there we go. Until April, okay, so her statue was there until April 2019 when the practice was discontinued amid controversy surrounding her 1931 recordings of That's Why Dogs Were Born and Pick a Ninny Heaven.
Kate Smith. All right. So the joke I had written in here was that, you know, she has a sofa reserved, so maybe 80 years later they'll remove the sofa in poor taste. But yeah, that's the connection that Kate Smith has with the area that's very close to where we record, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is a great city. All right. And we condone, well, we're not a big fan of racism.
Back to the cartoon. Then we transition to a table for the cast of the radio broadcast show Blondie, which is based on the Archie comic. And the joke being that there's a fire hydrant for the dog that's named Daisy. And that's the end of that joke.
Yeah, it didn't really hit with me either.
Yeah.
Next one works.
Meanwhile, yeah, this is fine. So meanwhile, there and you know, we can get check in. John.
Coat check room, yeah.
Yeah, the coat room, Johnny Wismuller. He checks in with the person there who's Paulette Goddard. And it turns out that, and again, this is a nice reference because, you know, honestly, thanks to Disney, we know who Tarzan is because Johnny Weissmuller was Tarzan. He was film Tarzan back in the 40s. So, which he's just as Tarzan, because just like today, any actor who played a pop culture figure dresses up like them all the time. Yeah. That's why Robert Downey Jr. walks around the Iron Man suit all the time.
Yeah, that's why Andy Serkis walks around naked.
Yes. And a little joke here, Sally Rand, who's famous for big...
fan dancing.
Fan dancing. Then in the next scene, we have three infamous gangster people.
Yeah.
James Cagney. James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart, and George Rapp. See, there's connections here between our last short and this one. Because
and the next one.
James Cagney, yes, because James Cagney is now in this short with Humphrey Bogart, who's in the next short. Anyways. Yeah.
And George Rapp, who's only in this one.
Yeah. With apologies to George Rapp.
We ran out of time.
We ran out of time to be put you in another cartoon. Anyways, so they're known for the tough guy roles, and they're kind of like, okay, no, we gotta only get one shot at this. And they just play a Depression era game of pitching pennies. It's silly. And then we have Harpo Marx, who's a comedy icon of the Marx Brothers. So the joke being that Harpo Marx just lights up a bunch of matches under Greta Garbo's feet.
She doesn't feel.
And Clark Gable, who is a womanizer, he finds this pretty girl. He just goes off screen in a like rotoscoped, like, hey, like I'm gonna go after her. All right, and then we finally get into the looseness, like the party kind of starts, because Crosby shows up. Because of course, you know, he's introducing the evening's entertainment, and because he loved a horse, you know, the bet on horse racing, a horse and its jockey just comes on stage.
I will say this joke is better only once rather than when they do it a second time.
Then Bing Crosby presents Leopold Stokowski.
Leopold.
Because, you know, he's wearing a snood or like a hairnet. And then he's about to do this serious orchestra performance. And of course, it's just the conga again. It's the conga. It's fine. Then as they're doing this, the conga then inspires sexy Dorothy Lamar at the time. And she's at a table with James Stewart to dance with her. And Jorn, I would like you to reenact this moment. So what does Jimmy Stewart do?
No, let me tell you, Mark. You see, so he's very, very shy. Very shy in this scene. He doesn't really want to dance with Dorothy Moore. So he just sort of bolts out of the scene and has a little card with Mr. Smith Goes to Washington on it. I think it's pretty I think it's real funny, actually.
That's what I've been resorted to on this program. Hey, impression boy, do some impressions.
All right, so and then we have Clark Gable. He comes back.
It's me again.
So he dances by.
I love that. Like, who else looks like that?
So it dances by, and then we have Tyrone Power dancing with Ice Skater, Sandra, Penny, Frankenstein's monster again. And then the Three Stooges show up in a cameo.
No, that's their thing.
And we have a nice little Hardy from the Gribble, Laurel, and Hardy, you know, dancing. And then he turns around and he gets it with two women because he's big, which is great. And then...
Yeah.
Cesar Romero. And the Joker shows up. And the joke for that, he's dancing with Rita Hayworth, and the joke being that they're very clumsy at dancing.
It requires a lot more significance if you're actually familiar with them in this period.
And then we cut over to Mickey Rooney with Judy Garland, which was a pleasant surprise. Like, oh, shit, I didn't know both of you. finally, a scene where I know the two people that are in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yay! Because, so Mickey Rooney, who was a kid star by this, still by this point. Yeah, he was still...
He was in the...
The Andy Hardy movies,
exactly.
Yeah, that was his still thing. He'd be in the Andy Hardy movies. Judy Garland would be in some of them. No, those, no.
He was also doing much better movies at this point.
Yeah.
Like ones that are still talked about to this day, you know, big fantasy superstar movies that are amazing and I will never say a bad thing about.
So Mickey Rooney, he gets the bill, and it's expensive, so he leans over to his father, who, okay, this is probably the biggest 1940s in-joke in the entire short. Is. He just talked to this random old guy who is actually modeled after Judge Hardy, which is the father of Mickey Rooney's Andy Hardy. Right. And for a favor, and then we transition, and they're dancing the dishes again to the conga beat.
That at least was a good payoff.
They got, that is a pretty good payoff. And my God, they're getting their money's worth out of this conga beat. 40s, everybody conga.
Yeah.
Anyways, and then Clark Gable shows up again, just going like, "Don't go away, folks. It's not good."
I love him in this.
He's great. We can then cut back to Bing Crosby introducing the future attraction of the evening. Of course, the horse comes back.
So the horse is dead in terms of idioms. Like, you know, they're beating a dead horse with this horse joke.
And then we...
By the way, just real quick, this Bing Crosby impression that that this voice actor is doing, that Kent Rogers is doing, is really good. This is probably his best impression.
Yeah, so then we get... Our third act, our last big main thing, which is 1940s Hollywood oogling over a seemingly naked, attractive naked woman hiding behind a giant bubble.
Yeah. You know.
That's what it is. It's
a horny grown man, you know, being normal.
40s. Yeah. The most interesting info I can give about this is... You know, it's a Tex Avery cartoon that involves men lusting over an attractive performer, which he would do, some would say, better, in Little Red Hot Riding Hood. So, yeah, a nice little practice round, I guess.
Yeah, essentially.
So, there's so many celebrities in this section. Okay, okay. So, the first person we see is Kay Kaiser, who's doing an old professor character. Shouts out students, and then a group of men wolf whistle and exclaim, "Baby." The people who are drawn are William Powell.
Okay.
Spencer Tracy.
Okay, good.
Ronald Coleman.
Okay.
Errol Flynn.
Amazing.
The Warner Bros. Has always had a thing with Errol Flynn, especially the cartoon department. They just love making Errol Flynn. Wallace Beery.
Yeah, okay.
And C. Audrey Smith.
Okay.
Then we cut to Peter Lorre, who is honestly giving the only wholesome response here. Where he's not fascinated by the woman. He's fascinated by the bubble.
Yes, I love this.
He says a beautiful bubble since I was a child.
That's a great joke.
It says here that may be a reference to his breakout role as a child murderer in M.
I don't think it is.
Then we have Henry Fonda, which I know that guy. Oh, I know I know his daughter and
son.
So, Harry Fonda's watching it, and then the voice of Alice Aldrich of the show The Aldrich Family, which, again, another radio broadcast show about teenagers and whatnot. And then J. Edgar Hoover shows up.
Yeah, and the G-Man.
And his only joke is just him saying, G, G, G.
You had to be there.
Then we have Boris Karloff.
Oh, yeah.
Arthur Treacher. Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
And Misha Arora. You're watching the action and the joke being that these are very deadpan actors. So then Ned Sparks, who was a movie grouch, very down guy, just saying, are they having a good time?
No.
Squidward.
No.
Oh my god, Ned. Wait, Ned Sparks is just Squidward. So Squidward just asked,
are you having a good time?
Yes.
Now, Patrick, that's a chorus line. See, I'm Mr. Impression Boy.
Speaking of.
Oh, yeah.
And Jacob, an Impression Boy who only gets one lousy impression. And it's so funny because we literally saw a cartoon where he did pretty good impressions. Mel Blanc has one impression, and it's of Jerry Colonna.
Yeah.
Colonna.
Who was also in the first one we talked about.
Yeah, he's a Jerry! That guy.
Yeah.
So he just says, guess who? And the camera reveals an invisible person next to him, which my brain first was like, oh, it's a reference to the Invisible Man. Like, whoever played the Invisible Man, that's a reference to him.
It's Claude Rains, yeah.
Not. It's Yehudi, which was his famous catchphrase, which was a reference to a violinist named Yehudi Mnuchin. Who him?
Again, you had to be there.
You had to be. I hate these damn names. All right, so then we have, now Harpo Marx comes back. He Dennis the Menace is
it. Yeah.
I forgot what's called. Anyways, shoots at the balloon. Reveals that she was actually just wearing a barrel for herself, which is funny. That's funny.
Then we get the payoff to the Clark Gable gag, right?
Yes. We then cut to Clark Gable saying, listen, baby, I've been chasing you all night. I want to be comfortable. And then she turns around, the disguise comes apart, revealing it's Groucho Marx.
Of course.
And he just says, well, fancy meeting you here. Then we fade out. Now, there's some interesting trivia.
Yeah.
That's not the real ending.
No, it's not.
The original ending was just, we fade back in after that moment, and Clark Gable just says, I'm a bad boy, and then we fade out.
I know we said that, oh, these Hollywood stars, they don't care about these cartoons. Clark Gable did, because Clark was worried that this would hurt his career. So we'll just give that. And there is some interesting trivia about these shorts. When we're painting across the tables, and there's a Bette Davis one, and she's not there. There actually was a caricature of Bette Davis made for this short, but it got cut. Yeah. They didn't use her. And of course, in terms of who lived the longest in this short, that was Mickey Rooney. He was the last survivor of this short until he's passing in 2014.
Yeah.
And about Kent Rogers, the amazing impressionist who did every male celebrity in this short, but Jerry Colonna. First of all, get envious about this, Jordan, because I think you would be envious of this. He was only 17.
Wait, really? He was 17 when he did all these impressions?
He was only 17.
Yo.
What the hell?
That's fantastic.
Yes. And then he died in July of 1944.
What?
The U.S. Navy. Yes, he died on July 1944. In Florida, because during a U.S. Navy training flight.
Okay.
Wow.
And in terms of any, you know, what do people think of the short back in the day, besides Clark Gable, the short is a the Film Daily called the shorts a caricature novelty, and that the latest Leon Schlesinger foray into the realm of caricature will interest and amuse.
Yeah.
Boy, isn't that the most 1940s?
It's the lowest common denominator. It'll interest you and amuse you. Like, yeah, it's not going to wow you or knock the pants off you. No, I'm slightly amused.
This was fine.
Yes.
In fact, I agree with that critique because...
Yeah.
This was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is fine. I do think it is important to state, because we talked about this last week, that you know, just because there is a reference to something that happened in the 40s that we understand, that doesn't make it bad. We just don't understand it unless we either grew up in that time or invested our college studies into learning about 1940s film and everything that went on around it. So... this isn't a bad short. My main issue with it is the second half. The second we get into showing all these celebrities dancing and stuff, you know, with Hardy and the Three Stooges and stuff, the cartoon really picks up from there. Yeah. The first, I want to say, about 2 minutes, it kind of drags. It's a little too wink wink.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. So I felt kind of lost there,
just a little.
But the second half is really good. I really dug the ending stinger there. Clark Gable issues with it aside, that's really funny. It makes sense that you end the short with the most funniest person at the time. Yeah. And in terms of a anvil rating, I might give this a 3.5 out of 5 anvils.
Okay. I'm giving it a 3 out of 5. Because, again, it's an amusing short. But once again, there's no real so what other than look at all these celebrities here. Let's make fun of them. It's a very shallow parody. And again, there are good jokes in here. There are good little things that happen. But a lot of this needs cliff notes in 2020. And if you can't watch a cartoon as is, if you can't watch something without needing a source material, but it's very much like a you need... A companion piece to this. You need to know, who all these people are. So it's fine, it works, but it's not as good as it could be, and that's why I give it only the 3 out of 5.
And again, for the older folks there, we gave it a 3. No.
Call your grandson. Anyway, want to cover a good one.
That'd be nice.
Oh, my God.
All right. Go ahead.
So this last one that we're doing, which is Slick Hair, is one of my favorites from growing up. I would watch this one a million times over and over when I had the second Golden Collection. Because fun fact, the second Golden Collection is the first one that I got. Like, I got the second one for Christmas in, like, 2004, maybe? Yeah. And I watched the hell out of that one before I would get the first one. I loved it as a kid. I loved the speed of the gags. I loved that it was Hollywood, but accessible Hollywood. I loved it was a good Bugs and Elmer one. And I quoted a lot of the lines of this to you in that era.
Oh.
All the time. So it's kind of fitting that we finished this one with Slick Hair because it's very much Hollywood. Before we get into the actual short, I did search up if anything notable happened on the day of the release, which was November 1st, 1947. And since you had a good music one with Bob Dylan, I've got a slightly less cool music one, but still pretty cool for enough audiences. So Mark, if I said the name Jim Steinman to you, would that mean anything to you?
Yes.
What does that mean to you?
Meatloaf, right?
Yes. Jim Steinman to this day was Meatloaf's Bernie Taupin, essentially. He was his official designated songwriter. And a lot of the big overdramatic melodic power ballads that you know Meatloaf for, you know, Bat Out of Hell, I'll Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That, I'd Lie for You and That's the Truth, Two Out of Three Ain't Bad, Paradise by the Dashboard Light. Again, I know a lot about music. Jim Steinman also worked for a lot of other singers. He did some stuff for Bonnie Tyler, both Looking Out for a Hero and Total Eclipse of the Heart was his writing. He did some songs for Air Supply. He did a lot of big 1980s and late 70s and early 90s sort of big power ballads. That's all Jim Steinman. And one of the big songs from the movie Streets of Fire, which it's a very campy rock and roll fantasy kind of movie from the 1980s. A lot of the soundtrack to that movie was Jim Steinman, which is pretty cool. So he's not Bob Dylan, but he's pretty cool. So, and also before we get into it, I'll mention that in addition to Mel Blanc and Arthur Q. Bryan, we got another vocalist to worry about in this one. We got Dave Barry, not to be confused with the contemporary comedian and humorist. Dave Barry, the voice actor, is responsible for doing the voice of Humphrey Bogart in this one. They would go back to Dave in a couple of years when they would do 8-Ball Bunny. Dave Barry would also voice Elmer Fudd in Pre-Hysterical Hair in 1959, the first Fudd cartoon without Arthur Q. Bryan, where he wouldn't be very good at the voice. But his Bogart's excellent. So the thing we need to worry about this is, you know, he does a really good Humphrey Bogart impression, and it's really good in this and in 8-Ball Bunny. So this is a Freeling piece. Ted Pierce and Michael Maltese do the script. Very fitting. It's very fitting to me that a Humphrey Bogart piece is written by a guy named Maltese. Thank you. I'll be here all week. We start with basically the same starting gag as Hollywood Steps Out, where it's basically, you know, it's a steep price to get in, no down payments. I mean, even the opening Leopold hairnet gag is the same as in Hollywood Steps Out, though I like this gag better, where he conducts the jukebox, swarms of people run to the dance floor and dance for about 10 seconds before running back to sit down. I like that. Now, this one also starts with a few more celebrity caricatures. So The first one's Gregory Peck, and him cutting his steak with a razor is a reference to the movie Spellbound, another Alfred Hitchcock movie. Ray Milland and his little cash registers is a reference to the movie The Lost Weekend, which won Best Actor and Best Picture at the Oscars a few years before. But nobody's bitter there, Bob. And Frank Sinatra, they're just taking the mic. They're just saying he's thin. And then we get our conflict, where Humphrey Bogart wants rabbit for dinner. Elmer is the charismatic waiter. Bugs, pretty close to modern style, both in design and voice, is saying, tell Bogey all he has to do is whistle, and then sets off the kettle, appears in the tux, and it's basically the joke about how everybody wants to be part of celebrity business. And it's like, if a celebrity wants to see me, I'll be there. And he doesn't realize he just wants to be eaten yet. I love that Bugs is doing this proper voice.
Good evening, Maitre D'. Am I the first to arrive? By the way, what's on the menu for tonight? In other words, what's cooking, Doc?
Like, that's such a very good, loud subversion that he does there.
Also, how is it that in the cartoon that is named What's Cooking, Doc, Bugs says that line in the short that's played in What's Cooking, Doc, but in this short called Slick Hair, he actually does say What's Cooking, Doc? What's up with that?
Because Bob Clampett sucks. I don't know. Again, Ruth, I'm sorry.
Also, the reason that Elmer has to get this rabbit is Humphrey Bogart has threatened to kill him.
Yes.
He tucks out a gun. Like, give me the rabbit in 20 minutes, which...
give me the rabbit in 20 minutes, or you'll never see your kids again. Sure. But yeah, no, so... Bugs wants to see the rabbit, not realizing it's him. Elmer hides a mirror in the pan, leading to a very good gag of Bugs seeing himself in the reflection in the pan. But I love Bugs' reaction after realizing and just holding it down and just looking horrified. And by the way, the other thing about this cartoon, Elmer is uncharacteristically smart in this cartoon. This is admittedly towards the end of Frizz writing Elmer, so it makes him a bit more clever. I mean, obviously later on he's going to have a few dumb moments. But he's a bit more wily and sly than he is in other earlier Frizz Elmer cartoons, which is nice. Okay, so after this is Bugs disguising himself as Groucho, right?
Yep.
Okay, good. And I love that, and I also love Elmer donning a Harpo Marx wig and cutting his cigar. Groucho impression, he has a great line. I hope you might not mind me slipping out of the explosion into a drop my chain. So good. There's a couple other smaller gags here, but there's a big cymbal crash when he runs into Sydney Green Street. I love that.
Which, of course, my little brain's like, oh, Alfred Hitchcock is big fat guy. Wait, no.
Sydney Green Street, star of The Maltese Falcon, Casablanca, and other movies. But he's basically, his whole thing is in the 1940s, he's essentially a foil for Humphrey Bogart a lot of the time. He's sort of the villain in a lot of movies.
Okay.
And he's really good. He speaks in this very aristocratic British accent, and he's very good in all of those, especially Casablanca. I think he's also in Key Largo, though I may be wrong. And now we get our dance sequence, because Bugs run into Carmen Miranda's fruity headdress. The cartoon stops for Viz. We have a Carmen Miranda song, and I will say the cartoon caricature of Carmen Miranda is a bit too stereotypical in how they design the wide, flat nose, but they don't do anything with her singing, which is fine. It's great. And then we get Bugs dancing. And that sequence is so damn fine. And so good and so well animated.
Yes.
Oh my God. These quick rhythmic gags, him just his legs in place as he plays banjo. Elmer Fudd sharpening his hatchet to the music.
Yes.
Bugs dancing on his ears. This is all beautiful and wonderful. And
yes.
I love it so much.
Yes.
And he runs off stage. And we follow this with one of my favorite gags in Looney Tunes history.
Well, before then, we get a little Bugs just going like, I'm a public. They love me. Which, that's Bugs.
Yes.
He already, again, Bob, should have known this.
Come on,
Bugs.
Bob
is better. Bugs is better when he already knows he's great.
Yes.
He doesn't need an academy or pretty much anyone else to tell him he's great. He already knows he's great. He loves his audience.
Yes. Gosh,
yeah.
I'm so unimportant.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
But this
right
here is one of my favorite gags in Looney Tunes history. The pie sequence.
Right.
The speed of this. The repetition of the dialogue. The timing. The fluid motions. The quickness. The rule of threes. All of this should be studied in any sort of comedy writing class. It's classic. It worked then. It works now. And the dialogue, the repeated dialogue of pick up pie, Roger, your pie, sir, and then him getting hit in the face is so good. And I repeated it all the time back in the day.
One lemon meringue pie. One lemon meringue pie coming up. Pick up pie. Roger, your pie, sir. One banana cream pie. One banana queen pie coming up. Pick up pie. Roger. Your pie, sir.
It was so
yes.
Damn good and still is. And what really got to me this time is the third time when Elmer finally figures it out. And the fact that it takes him two tries to say, say, I think that's the rabbit. The first two tries, no, that could be anybody. But the third try, say, I wonder if that's the rabbit. The person screwing with me on a repeated basis, I wonder if that's the rabbit. This is why Elmer Fudd is a great character. He's such an unreceptive idiot, especially in a lot of these. I said he was more clever in this, but in this, he's just the right amount of harebrained, no pun intended. And the ending of this. Do you like the ending of this? Because I do.
Yeah. It's okay because Elmer, he's like, okay, it's an out of the pie. It's you. Throws it. Bugs ducks. It hits Humphrey Bogart.
Yes.
But he walks to the kitchen and just great straight-laced says,
why did you hit me in the face with a coconut custard pie with whipped cream?
He detects the pie exactly. He doesn't need anybody to tell him. He knows what pie it is.
And we're just going like, I'm sorry, Mr. Bogart. I don't have a rabbit. He just goes, you have 5 minutes. And just Elmer just going through the drawers, and there's a clock on the wall. Literally 30 seconds goes by.
Yes.
Time goes fast when you're stressed.
Yes. Well, yeah, it is.
You both know. So then immediately, clock goes off. Elmer, he's kind of begging. He's like, listen, I'm so sorry. We don't have Rabbit. And
I twied.
And then Bogor just says, okay, well, he goes into his coat pocket. And of course, Elmer's just like begging for mercy. And Bogor just goes, well, baby, we'll just have to have a ham sandwich instead.
And I love this because Bugs realizes that, you know, if I'm going to be eaten by Humphrey Bogart, it's bad. I can't have that. If I'm going to be eaten by Lauren Bacall, say, that's amazing. I'll gladly be eaten by Lauren Bacall. And just leaps onto the plate. I love it.
With the apple.
And yes. It's a non sequitur ending that makes it so much funnier. So I still like this one a lot. It's not perfect. It's a little unfocused in points. I feel like the we didn't need the entire Carmen Miranda bit. I feel like some parts were a little unfocused, but I could have used one or two more undeniably funny gags. But this is still a really good one. It's a better Hollywood satire than the first two because it's actually satirizing, you know, the culture of, you know, celebrities wanting things that they can't even attain, and it's a lot more of a point thing. And I love that Bugs just wants to be part of celebrity culture, even if he's being eaten by celebrity culture. There's better gags. There's better silly Bugs stuff. There's better characters. And there's a lot of points that still work, even all these years later, even if Bogart and Bacall aren't as relevant or alive. So it's a favorite of mine. It's still a really good one. I gave it a 4.5 out of 5.
I'm going to give this a 5 out of 5.
Oh!
I personally had no issues with this show. Cool. It's just as good as I remember it. Yeah. You could give the argument like, oh, maybe the dance scene could have been cut down, but it is so entertaining. That's the thing. You can have just random stuff happening that doesn't really tie to the plot, but if it's animated well, if it's really funny, then who cares? You know? Also, I will say, though, that I do find that them having Humphrey Bogart be the lead celebrity of this short helps it out incredibly well in terms of relevancy.
Yes.
Because as we've seen in these three shorts, a lot of the celebrities in the 40s never either they had that blockbuster fame, but it diminished within the 50s and 60s, or they were never that big to begin with. Don't quote me on that. Anyways, but I think the fact having Bogart be the lead, Casablanca is still watched every year.
A lot of his movies are still watched.
Hell, the African Queen. I saw that in film appreciation course. It's a great movie.
Yeah, like
it's a great
movie. Just from not only Casablanca but also Maltese Falcon is great. Key Largo is great. Big Sleep is great. He's in Angels with Dirty Faces with James Cagney. That's a great one. He's one of those American icon, sort of rugged American icon, sort of character actors and actors in general that just has enough charm and enough something about him to really transport himself through his era where he was relevant to now, which is fantastic.
Anyways, it's really good. It's really good. I really did enjoy this one.
Yeah, I do find it funny though that I was harder on all three cartoons than you were.
Yeah, I don't know how it's possible. You have more classic movie knowledge than I do. I don't know how.
But at the same time, I know I'm not judging these as classic movies. I'm judging these as successful cartoons, and they can have as many celebrities all they want from the 1940s. But they have to do a good cartoon with them, and two of these didn't. So, you know.
Okay, so for next week's show, we're going to go to war. Wait, no, we're not. No.
No? No.
Bye from Iraq!
No. Yeah, that'll help. That'll help us get viewed by all the 90-year-olds. They'll turn it off then.
Hi from Iraq. It's Saturday night. Oh no!
And your host.
Brian Adam Sandler, bring peace to the Middle East, sir. Yes. Perfect.
Adam, say something coherent. No. All right. So what are we doing next week, all other right. than making fools of ourselves?
Okay. Oh, we do everything.
Yes, we do.
No, we're going to be doing. We're going to be talking about some wartime Looney Tunes cartoons.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about Falling Hair, Drafty Daffy, and Super Rabbit.
Very nice. It'll be interesting to talk about all of those.
Yes. And I sure hope we don't piss off anyone who really loves one of these cartoons.
Spence, if you're listening, hi.
Thanks for getting the word out about our show. Really?
Yeah. I guess we do a shout out here for Spence 12 Mad B, who's been doing a lot of our pub. And I'm also going to shout out my girlfriend, Katie Michelle, for being a big support with all this 30s and 40s movie knowledge, and also for being the best girlfriend on the face of the earth.
All right. So if you want to follow the podcast on Twitter or us on Twitter, you can follow me at MarkHalem1995.
And you can follow me at TallGuySchmidt.
If you want to keep up with the podcast and give your thoughts for next week's shorts, you can follow at @that_Looney or type in the podcast title. We are the first results.
We're also available on every podcasting, broadcasting app and things. We're on your standard Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Player FMs. Without too much in trouble with the law, we are on there most likely.
All right, so... until next week, I'm Mark.
And I'm Jordan, and I will leave you with the sitcom featuring Adam Sandler and Jimmy Stewart.